Now the question that you have asked, has mankind made progress? This question is loaded with many other suggestions in the universe. The Bhagavad Gita itself says, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati. Shri Krishna is aware that even if now dharma is restored, again it will go back to glani. Again it will be lost. Even if the wicked are punished now, then again they will rise up. Then the loaded question is, then what is the point? If all that you do ultimately is again going to be ruined, and what is the point in it? Progress really would mean that a problem which has been resolved one time does not recur. The other loaded question is it possible to arrive at a point where these evils will really be eradicated once for all? Is the world such, is the world so constituted that it is possible to overcome evil and wicked people once for all? Even if that is so, then why is it up till now recurring again and again? Is it that the world is simply a cycle? You go from bad to good and again you return to bad. Is the world so constituted it is only to be like this? A deeper question is it really so? Is it really true that the evil recurs again and again? In the same way, in the same intensity? Or is there some misreading of our own history? All these questions are involved. And if this question can even be formulated with a greater vehemence. There is one very interesting passage in the Life Divine. And I'm going to read to you that passage where the question that you have raised is presented with a greater force. Can you distribute this? Give me one page. Now in the middle of the page you will find this argument. Sri Aurobindo argues the argument that you have presented in a very formidable manner. This is not Sri Aurobindo's standpoint, but he has made an argument coming from those who question the idea of progress. So if you see in the middle, the idea of human progress itself, did you get that sentence? Did you get that sentence?
The eighth sentence in the second paragraph.
The idea of human progress itself, have you got it, all of you? Then we shall read it. The idea of human progress itself is very probably an illusion. For there is no sign that man, once emerged from the animal stage, has radically progressed during his race history. At most, he has advanced in knowledge of the physical world, in science, in the handling of his surroundings, in his purely external and utilitarian use of the secret laws of nature. But otherwise, he is what he has always was in the early beginnings of civilization. He continues to manifest the same capacities, the same qualities and defects, the same efforts, blunders, achievements, frustrations. If progress there has been, it is in a circle, at most perhaps in a widening circle. man today is not wiser than the ancient seers and sages and thinkers, not more spiritual than the great seekers of old, the first mighty mystics, not superior in arts and crafts to the ancient artists and craftsmen. The old races that have disappeared showed as potent an intrinsic originality, invention, capacity of dealing with life. And if modern man in this respect has gone a little farther, not by any essential progress, but in degree, scope, abundance, it is because he has inherited the achievements of his forerunners. Nothing warrants the idea that he will ever hew his way out of the half-knowledge, half-ignorance, which is the stamp of his kind, or even if he develops a higher knowledge, that he can break out of the utmost boundary of the mental circle. So this is a much vaster argument against all those who claim that mankind has made progress. Even today we find Duryodhanas and Kansas among ourselves. Even if you say that there has been a great spiritual development, then the argument is that rishis like Vishwamitra and Vasishtha were even greater mystics than today. So what is the progress at all? So having sharpened this argument, now let us see the true answer to this question. First of all, we must ask our question, how shall we determine the yardstick of progress? When shall we say, now we have made a progress? One answer would be that we shall say that progress has been made when the mankind will not return back again on certain achievements, such as goodness, saintliness, spread of luminosity, knowledge, good governance, good neighborliness, harmony, unity. All these have been preached by all the great avatars who have come. They have established for a short time. But again it has returned back like the dog's tail. So we shall say that according to us, progress will really mean a stage where once having been achieved what was to be achieved in terms of unity and harmony, what Ram Rajya ultimately established, or what Yudhishthira established after his conquests, and which remained for some time, when this does not get reversed, then we shall say now a real progress has been achieved. This will be our special yardstick. So far it has not happened, therefore we say there has been no progress. So this is one yardstick. Now the question is it a correct yardstick? I already defined it, but does it mean that what I am saying is justified? The answer is that although it is justified, it needs to be qualified to some extent. We must ask ourselves, what is a human being basically? And what do we expect of a human being in terms of progress? We shall find that the human being is basically a complex being. It has a physical body. It has vital energies and urges. It has got a mind. And then it has got spirits. So man has four elements. And when we say progress, we should mean really progress in all the four directions. Physical direction, vital direction, mental direction, and spiritual direction. At present, I have defined progress only on one dimension, namely spiritual dimension. namely in terms of unity, harmony, good sense, goodwill, etc., which is a moral and spiritual dimension. But what about the other dimensions? If certainly man gets into the spiritual dimension and manifests it fully, then of course there is no doubt that we shall certainly certify that now progress has been registered. But is that all that we should demand? Basically, human being is to be defined as a rational being. The definition of man is that he is a rational being. Not only rational being, but a rational animal. That is to say, we do not rule out the animality in man. So, we should expect first of all the development of man in terms of his animality and in terms of his rationality. If you find that progress has been made in these two directions, then at least we should say that basic progress has been made. Now let us look at the whole history of the world from this point of view. Since man is complex, all the four elements will manifest from time to time. But the degree of development in one domain will differ from age to age. If you examine the whole history, you will be able to find out that there is a pattern in this development of history of mankind. Although all the four elements develop simultaneously, but this development is, as it were, a zigzag development. Because man is complex, so you cannot say that only one thing is to be stressed first, other things to be stressed later on. All the four elements move in a zigzag manner, but even there is a design. The predominance of development of bodily existence is first of all stressed in history. Since man is an animal, basically, so his animality has to be first of all securely established. If humanity can do that first, you can say that at least the first basic thing has been done. In history, therefore, in the beginning, mankind was stressing basically this element. Although other elements also were present, vital element, mental element, spiritual element, all elements are to be found right from the early history. Even the early history shows that man was religious. Some kind of religion was present, so spiritual element was still present. Even in the early times you find that not only religious element, but even a great spirituality developed. If the Vedas were the great works of spiritual knowledge and wisdom, then it is certainly true that in ancient times, spiritual development took place in a very large scale, on a very lofty level. This is historical evidence. So spiritual development also was given a great place even in the early times. But still, history was interested first to establish the physical of man. So even when the physicality was being established, other elements were not neglected. They were also developed. But they were developed for a time being, in an insecure manner. Until the lower base is sufficiently secure, even if you build on the higher plane something great, it doesn't remain secure. And that is the reason why great edifice of spiritual knowledge either went into oblivion or some kind of incomprehension or even a loss. As Sri Krishna says himself, that this great knowledge of Karma Yoga was given by me first to Vivaswan and then to Manu and then to Ikshvaku, and then it went on from as a tradition, and ultimately it got lost. Why did it get lost? The reason is that intention of nature is not merely to develop spiritual knowledge, but also to secure development of the totality. And in the beginning, the preponderant attention of nature is to establish the base. All the civilizations that you study in history were first concerned with the physical security of man. You may call him a barbarian, and the history certainly shows a large-scale barbarism. But what was the barbarian doing? The primitive man was trying to get food, clothing, shelter on a secure basis. That was his fundamental concern. Whether it is Egyptian civilization or a Chinese civilization or Persian civilization or Babylonian civilization or Indian civilization, of which we have got some kind of records, the earliest occupation of man was to establish physically the human being on the earth. Even for human survival in the beginning was difficult because so many jungles, so many beasts, so many animals, so many risks, so much of ignorance, obscurity, quarrels, battles. So the ancient civilization's history is nothing but quarrels and battles of all various kinds, resulting in what is called civilization. Now, what is the meaning of civilization? The word civilization comes from the word civil. A stage where civil life gets secured is called civilization. And what is civil life? Civil life is the life in which law and order, some kind of physical facilities, so that physical life is not diluted, and some kind of modicum comfort. If any historical epoch establishes this much, we can say it is a civilization. So earlier civilizations tried to establish the physical, as yet not fully, but greatly. So you might say that the history of mankind at least shows that civil life began to be developed. And even if one civilization broke down, it was not so difficult to build up another civilization much more quickly than the first civilization. So the speed with which a new civilization, even after the breakage, gives you measure of progress. So we can say, yes, mankind made this much progress. In recent times, for example, after the great Second World War, there was devastation. Germany particularly was devastated. Japan was devastated. And yet within a short time, they have been built up. Now that shows that humankind has now a possibility and a capacity by which the quickness with which a civilization can be built up, that capacity man possesses today. So let us say there is one progress on that one line mankind has achieved. Then the next step of human civilization was marked by establishment of vital energy. Now what is vital interested in? When can you say the vital being is sufficiently developed, sufficiently established in the world? The main urges of the vital being are acquisition, possession, influencing, enjoyment, aggrandizement, domination. These are the basic urges of the vital. So human history has to give sufficient space where these urges are allowed to manifest. Before you can establish, they should at least be allowed to manifest. That is why a large chunk of history was spent in allowing these urges to manifest. One of the great examples of this vital urge is Genghis Khan. When human civilization was sufficiently quiet and quite developed, and there was prosperity physically, there was sufficient base, suddenly this great man strode on the earth and devastated things. Devastated for what reason? Just for the sake of the manifestation of the vital energy. Domination, acquisition. I must possess not this much land but more land. I must be the greatest. The established thing should be all thrown out because I want a new energy, new development, new creativity. Genghis Khan is only one example, but a number of them arose in history. So you might say that the second level of human history was spent in allowing this kind of tendency to come out, to have its own experience, and to learn from it. One of the last ones was Hitler in this direction. For no reason he wanted Germany to expand. No reason means he had his own reasons. But from a rational point of view, we find there was no point. He wanted Poland, he wanted some other neighboring lands, and then he began to dream of the whole world to be Germanized. But from a certain point, you can say there was no reason for it. But it is this desire to expand. So what was in Hitler was, as it were, you might say, one of the last vestiges of this vital period of human history. But prior to Hitler, there are many others, even much more dangerous, much greater. Sri Aurobindo calls Hitler only a dwarf Napoleon. He was basically a dwarf compared to Napoleon. Napoleon also had a big hunger, a big appetite. He ran over the whole of Europe and conquered land after land. That is why when we read history, we only find that great people come on the scene and they begin to quarrel. They begin to fight. They begin to have wars. So history is nothing but a history of wars. And our children complain, what is there to study in history? It is nothing but history of wars. Constantly people come and quarrel and then they become victorious and again be defeated. This is all. Even the story of Mahabharata is what? The story for domination. The story of conquest. The means by which you can influence large number of people. This is what Duryodhan wanted. So a large chunk of human history was the manifestation of the vital energy. And if you study even history much more neatly and much more carefully, you'll find that even there are certain subtle designs. Because even vital has many aspects. I told you just now, acquisition, possession, domination, enjoyment, influence and so on. So some wanted only domination, some wanted enjoyment, some wanted acquisition, some wanted possession. Some wanted just to enjoy the quarrel for the sake of quarrel. So there was a long period given to mankind to work out these vital and to learn out of it and then ask oneself, so what if I do all this? And today's mankind is asking this question. Even children ask the question, so what if you conquer this or conquer that? This is a learning from human history. And today's humanity has learned what is war and why should there be war. Even the questioning of war, at one time there was no questioning. People thought that war is the normal way of life. There should be wars. But today we ask the question, why should there be wars at all? So you might say, mankind has therefore progressed from that point to this point. Third is the development of the mind. If mankind has made a progress in the field of the mind, then we may say in a certain sense that mankind has really made a progress, because man is fundamentally distinguished from the others by his rationality, by his mentality. So let us look at the history now from the point of view of mental development. Now, as far as mental development is concerned, one of the best examples is the Greek civilization, the Greek culture. One of the earliest developments in human history is illustrated in Greek history. India also is a very great example in this respect. China also is a great example in this respect. These three particularly, as far as mental development of early history is concerned, we can examine them and see what they did, what they achieved. In India, intellectuality was given a tremendous place. Even if you read Mahabharata, there may be dispute as to who wrote Mahabharata, whether there was only one writer who wrote Mahabharata and all that. But the fact is that we have got this big book before us, whoever might have written. There are 1 lakh of verses there. To produce this gigantic work of 1 lakh verses is a tremendous intellectual feat by any standard. It is a tremendous feat because it contains, as it is said, what is not in Mahabharata is not anywhere else. And all that is there is in Mahabharata. This is what has been said. And not absolutely without basis. Every possible subject is discussed in Mahabharata. Not only discussed cursorily, but in detail. Even Bhagavad Gita, which is a part of the Mahabharata, you can see that it is a detailed exposition of what is karma, what is not karma, what is jnana, what is bhakti, what is the highest achievement. And you might even say profusely it has been discussed. On the battlefield to discuss such a long question and such a long, at such length, whether it happened or not is a different question, but the fact is that we have this Bhagavad Gita in our hands, which is sufficiently long and sufficiently detailed. And even production of this book, only this little episode, is a tremendous achievement from intellectual point of view. Apart from spiritual point of view, intellectually even, it's a tremendous feat to produce 700 verses and to put into them so many subjects and with so much of clarity, so much of precision, that even today when we try to understand, we take so much time to understand it. But there is only one episode. But look at the dialogues that we have of Vidura. Vidura Niti of how to govern. It's a great long discussion how to govern. Even dialogue between Bhishma and Yudhishthira as to how to govern the state. Even when he was on the deathbed, he discusses how to govern the state properly. And everywhere the question is why it should be done, how it should be done, in what proper manner it should be done. So it is like a shastra, a scientific inquiry into every possible subject is given in Mahabharata. So Mahabharata itself is a great example of robust intellectuality. And not merely that, Mahabharata is only one example. What about Ramayana? And then what about shastras of various kinds which developed? There are six Vedangas, first of all. After the Vedas, there are 6 Vedangas. Then there are 4 Upavedas. This is in early times. And all of them are so well defined and so intellectually chiseled. It's an amazing treat. And then if you look into the development of mathematics, astronomy, astrology, medicine, and all kinds of sciences. It is said India developed 64 sciences and 64 arts. This is ancient India. In other words, human history emphasized the development of the mind very intensively. Now go to Greece. There also there was a tremendous emphasis on aesthetics, science and art of beauty. That's why art, sculpture particularly in Greece, even today, we regard Greek sculpture as something supreme. They developed before 4th century BC. Development of philosophy. Socrates and Plato. It is said that Plato wrote so greatly that entire history of Western philosophy is footnotes to Plato. So how much he wrote, if you look at the dialogues of Plato and the intellectual heights, supreme heights of intellectuality, you find in Plato. China invented so many things in the earliest times. In fact, most of the inventions of ancient times came to us from China or over the world. In other words, even when physical was being developed, vital was being developed, mind was not left behind. Human history ensured that even mental development was greatly developed. In the field of spirituality, we saw that the people who wrote Upanishads and the Vedas must have been spiritually very great. But the attention of history was not on spirituality. It was not on intellectuality. It was largely on the physical and the vital. Unless they are sufficiently developed, greatly cultivated, greatly established, the other edifices cannot remain for long. Therefore, they collapsed. So why do they collapse? The answer is they collapse because the attention of history is first to build up the physical and the vital. That is why intellectuality and spirituality, which were being developed from time to time, they collapse from time to time. So when we examine human history, we should ask these questions. At least physical and vital were sufficiently established. If intellectuality was developed, was intellectuality sufficiently developed? And if it collapsed only because it was not widely distributed? The answer is that even though intellectuality and spirituality developed in earlier times, they remained within small groups of people. Even in the times of the Vedic rishis, it is not as if all the people living in Vedic times came to know what is in the Veda. In fact, only a small group of people became rishis. But large number of people were savages. If you see Ramayana, Vishwamitra comes to Dashrath saying, we are doing yajnas, sacrifices according to Vedic rites, but we are being disturbed by huge monsters and we want to be protected. So even while there were rishis like Vishwamitra, the vital and physical beings represented by the Rakshasas were very heavy and they were ready to destroy and they were not sufficiently conquered. So the history's attention was to conquer them. That is why Rama and Lakshman had to go in their youth to destroy those Rakshasas. That means that large population was ignorant, did not participate in the heights of the Vedic spirituality. If you go to Greek history, It was mainly Athens, one city in which the glory of Greece developed to great pinnacles. But the other states, they did not partake in it. They were overrun afterwards by the Romans, who were savages. So intellectual development of Greece was submerged. Why? Because the vital powers had still their own history to make, and they were allowed large room, and their great civilization was allowed to break down. So from a point of view of the development of intellect, you might say there was a breakdown. But from the point of view of the development of the vital, which had to be given a large room, that was secured. Human history is therefore a kind of a zigzag in which different powers are allowed to develop, even to reach climax, but the attention was on different planes, which had to be given a larger room, larger place. So in the first place, physical was given a large place, then vital was given a large place, then came the age of the intellect. Now look at the history of our modern times. Since the time of Renaissance, Renaissance is supposed to be starting with 1492, that is the date of Renaissance commencement. From 1492 to the present day, now you can see the age of intellectuality. By 1492, physical and vital beings were sufficiently developed. It didn't mean therefore they had reached their climax and there was no further clamor of the physical and the vital. But they were sufficiently developed so as to give a room now, a larger room, for the intellectual development of mankind. Within last 500 years, it's an unprecedented story of the intellectual development. Even though in ancient times intellect was developed, I give you examples of it. But never was intellectual development made so widespread, the sharing of intellectual development, as today, during the last 500 years. Larger sections of people have becoming more and more intellectual. They are sharing the philosophic culture, the artistic culture, and all fields of morality and aesthetics. All these elements were developed and shared. Important point is sharing. A historical development is to be judged by the height that you reach and by the largeness of sharing that you can make. Now, in the past stages of history, there was pinnacle achieved from time to time, but because it was not being shared by a large number of people, there was a possibility of attack and destruction. Now, during the last 500 years, even though wars took place, even though vital was still allowed to play a great role, still there was sufficient stability of civilization as to allow the development of intellect in number of subjects. The multiplicity of inquiry that you find during the last 500 years in Europe was incredible. The subjects that were inquired, the methods of inquiry that were developed, particularly the methods of induction, experimentations that have been done, discoveries that have been made, the inventions that have been made, so that during the last 500 years we have surpassed the pinnacles of the past in various domains of intellectual development. Today's astronomy in last 500 years has surpassed all astronomical developments of the past. So even if you have reached great heights in the past, today's heights are much greater. and widespread development. In the past, the development was not widespread. Educational systems of the past restricted access to education. It was difficult to get education in most of the times of history. It is during the last 500 years that education is made very widespread. We speak of education for all. We want everyone to be educated. Now, even in the field of intellect, there are three domains. The physical intellect, the vital intellect, and the pure intellect. And therefore, within last 500 years, all the three, one after the other, have been developed, and very largely. Now, it is not that at that same time, other domains are not developing. But a special space was given to the development of intellect. It is true that some of the intellectual heights which were reached earlier may have been some very greater than even now. It's quite possible. In certain intellectual developments, the peaks which were reached were greater. For example, it can be said that the intellectuality that you find in Mahabharata even now remains unsurpassed in some respects. The conclusions which are reached in some of the domains of philosophy even now remains unsurpassed. But this is compensated by subtlety. In any domain, there are three aspects to be seen. The height that you reach, the subtlety that you reach, complexity and profundity that you reach. All the three aspects are to be seen. For fullness, you should have all the three. Your height should be the highest, subtlety must be the subtlest, and complexity and profundity must be the deepest. When you can combine all the three, then you can say, now this is perfected. And you will see that when these three things are achieved, then there is no collapse. No return again. Until you reach these three perfections, because you are not in perfection, there is a possibility of a collapse. During this last 500 years, therefore, intellect not only developed in the sense of physical intellect, that is why physics is the science of physical intellect. Vital intellects, the development of all other arts and applications, technologies. This is vital intellect. And the pure intellect is in the field of philosophy, pure speculation, pure thought. In all the three respects, not only that, but it went one step further. Intellect came to recognize the necessity of conceiving ideals, which was always the case. Intellect always. But how to apply ideals on a large scale in the society so that the whole society shares those ideals? This new idea sprang up in the West on a very large scale. Take for example, in France, and it's not only France, but England, America, but it especially crystallized in France. In France, the great thinkers thought of three great ideals of the intellect. Ideal of liberty, equality, and fraternity. And said that if you want a rational life in the world, reasonable life, a good life in the world, then people should have freedom of thought and expression. There should be equality so that the wide gulfs which exist today between the rich and the poor should be reduced or eliminated. And there should be a feeling of brotherliness among people. Now, having conceived these ideals, the whole of France went into a great revolution. and said, in the whole of France, we want liberty, equality, fraternity. Not only that, but Napoleon, who came forward at the end of the French Revolution, he carried these three ideas all over Europe. One of the great results of Napoleonic wars was that these three ideals went round the whole of Europe. So although French Revolution failed in France, but these three ideals, they went round. And it inspired revolutions in other countries in the same way. And even today, even if you read our Indian Constitution, which was framed in 1950, you will find the very preamble speaks of justice, liberty, equality, fraternity. Even today. So the effect is so widespread that those ideals are now getting more and more established. But even that is now found, that you may put the ideals, you may even share the ideals, you may try to implement them, but today's history has now shown that they are not implementable except in very minor degree. Therefore, a new realization is coming upon mankind. How to implement these three great ideals? How to bring about a situation where there is sufficient room? And it was found that unless you have peace in the world, and a durable peace, you cannot really establish the kingdom of liberty, equality and fraternity. Now you judge history from this point of view. Has mankind made a progress in securing an institution which never existed in the whole world history, which is in charge of world peace, an institution which is in charge of world peace, so that if any war arises anywhere, this institution is a power. United Nations Organization, as Shirobindo said, the establishment of UNO is a momentous development of human history. Never in history of the world it was conceived that all the nations must unite together and must create machinery by which war, wherever it arises, it should be immediately quelled. Immediately forces should start to bring about peace. So you might say that humanity, in spite of all these falls and rises and so on, and why they came about, we understand. Ultimately, it has reached a point where three things have become irreversible. One, a movement towards the gathering of all the people of the world. In the past, there were attempts, but institution never came into existence where this can be secured, where it becomes irresistible, irreversible. In early times, we had Augustus Caesar in Roman Empire, who brought under the Roman Empire the largest tax of the lands of the world to make one empire, so that the people could come together under one regime, and therefore some kind of unity of people was secured, and very powerfully did it. Yet it collapsed because there was something wrong which was not stabilizing. In other words, the efforts of Augustus Caesar were good, great, heroic, but they were not sufficient. For example, he tried to establish Roman Empire and imposed upon it one language, saying that uniformity will bring about the unity, which did not work. So one lesson had to be learned, that if you try to bring people of the world together under the force of one language, it won't work. He also tried to bring the whole world by means of domination, by power, central power, centralization, rule of one language, and rule of centralization. It didn't work. By centralization, what happens is that a small center develops at the center, which becomes all powerful. What is developing all over is neglected, and revolts begin to start in all over, and their own needs, local aspirations, they are neglected. It is not an ideal solution. You must find a means by which the unity of people does not crush decentralizing forces of the world. Now, today if you look at United Nations Organization, it has been able to achieve two things. One is bringing all the people together. Every year conferences are held, General Assembly of United Nations meets, in which all the nations meet together, in which even the smallest state is given as much right of vote as the highest. Even there is some defect because of veto power of five powers. Even there is a defect and which is coming as a trouble. That is why United Nations may not be so stable. It may also collapse one day because of this reason. You must ultimately create a situation where every decentralized part, which has its own life, gets support. Then only it will not collapse. The second point in United Nations is that there is a great cry for peace. The forces of war exist in the world. Threats of war exist. Even after the United Nations came into existence, hundreds of wars have taken place in the world. But the cry for peace is now preponderant. It has been able to quell. The World War III could not start for many reasons. There was a possibility of a threat of the World War III. It is still not receded. But so long, at least we can say, at least for 55 years, we have been able to thwart the actualization of the threat of the Third World War. And this is largely due to the existence of the United Nations Organization. So the forces of peace, the forces of unity, which does not disturb fundamentally the decentralization and variation in the world. Now, this is one of the great achievements of human history, you might say, that ultimately after so many years of travail, we have been able to create this organization. And as a result of United Nations Organization, we are now in a position to create other bodies like UNESCO. It also stands for education for people in the terms of peace. On a wide scale, the whole world. Never in history of the world did you have an organization, a universal organization, pleading for education for all in the lessons of history of peace. An international standard. To construct such an organization, there was a need to have behind it the history of a long period of trouble, labor, pain, all kinds of efforts of humankind for thousands of years to be able to arrive at this point today, which is still fragile. You can't say that now there will be no recurrence, there will be no fall. There could be. But we can understand from this whole history that history does not want easy solutions, temporary solutions. If anything is constructed which is not stable, which is not widespread, which is not shared, it breaks. Because it wants something that is really formidable, something that will not reverse. Sri Aurobindo has spoken of the law of evolution. The law of evolution is the following. In the first place, there is a foundation on which evolutionary journey can be built. Our foundation is foundation of matter. The whole evolutionary process is meant for creating, you might say, a divine temple. What is the whole world ultimately trying to achieve? It is to create a physical temple in which divine consciousness can vibrate. In other words, to create the kingdom of God on the earth. What is God is Satchidananda. So the truth and consciousness and knowledge and delight, these three things should vibrate fully and irresistibly. But on the physical plane, stabilized. This is the aim of the whole human history. And we have to ask the question, how far this temple is built? And then measure the progress of man. So first of all, the physical foundation itself has to be secured. When the foundation is sufficiently secured, then the forms of that foundation become multiplied. This is the law of evolution. Whenever you establish, this will happen even in our small endeavors, you first of all build a factory. In the beginning, there will be only one central office. Afterwards, when you develop it further, then small centers or official organs will begin to grow. So, this is the second principle. First, foundation. Then multiplication of forms. And multiplication of different kinds of forms. This is the second stage of development. When this sufficiently arises, then there is a movement of ascent. Ascent means a new principle is introduced and the effort moves forward to sustain the ascent. So there is an ascending movement. First was only foundational movement, horizontal movement. Then the multiplication of it. The third is ascent. You now try to develop a new principle. As in human history, first when the physical foundation was established, the second was a development towards the vital. It was an ascent towards vital development. Then what happens is once you reach the higher level sufficiently, then there is a principle of integration. Whatever is achieved at a higher level, you bring back on the lower level. In the first place, there was only the physical existence. Then came the vital existence in a very powerful way. Then the physical existence was vitalized. In the first place, it was only physical foundation. Then there was an ascent towards the vital. The third stage was vitalizing first physical. Now, while you try to vitalize the physical, it may seem from external point of view as if you are moving downwards. So, if you are not trying to understand the inner meaning, you might say now there is a fall. Earlier movement was towards heightening towards the vital. Now comes a movement which is downward. But downward for what purpose? Not to retain the physical foundation as it was before, but to vitalize it. But from outside point of view, it may look as if now it is collapsing. There is a downward movement. After integration, once again, there is a further development of the vital principle in different forms, newer forms, of vital existence come into being. When they are sufficiently multiplied, not only multiplied, but when they are subtilized, when they are greatly deepened, they become more complex. Then again there is an ascent. Ascent to a higher principle. Now after vital, the higher principle is the mental. In the mental, when you reach, first of all, there are great ascents to the mind. After the mind achieves a great deal of ascents, then it begins to descend. To mentalize the physical, to mentalize the vital, and then again, to bring all the riches of vitalized mind and vitalized physical and mentalized physical up to the higher level. This is where we are today in history.
But what do you mean by vitalizing the physical, for example?
Physical is normally inert. Whenever there is a security in a society, it gets satisfied. And it does not want to move forward. The principle of inertia sets into it. This is, you might say, physical nature. Now, when you want to vitalize the physical, what you do is that you goad it. You don't allow settling down into inertia. You infuse the physical existence with new dreams, new visions, new energies, new conquests. All kinds of novelties are introduced. So the physical becomes vitalized. Otherwise, this happens even in a small household. Once the household becomes quite settled, routine sets in, daily everything, the same things happen, and suddenly you will find that children will begin to demand novelties. Guests will come into your house, they will bring new ideas. Sometimes we might even say that since these people have come, my whole routine is ruined, my stability is gone, my old prosperity is gone. But actually, it is from evolution's point of view, if these forces had not come in, you would have settled down into inertia, it would have collapsed even in any case. Which you do not realize. But inertia always brings about a collapse ultimately. This has also happened wherever new ideas are not allowed, even in a household, after some time, with sufficient resistance to newness, ultimately it collapses. That is why from evolution's point of view, when new things come, you must know how to receive the new things. It is true that new things always disturb you, they even ruin your present status and tranquility. But that is because you do not know how to receive the new things. This is what you will learn from evolution. So, physical development is always followed, whether you like it or not, by invasion of the vital. Even when you want to keep quiet, you say, now I am fully established, my whole thing is wonderfully arranged, I don't want anything more now, you go on the routine, everything is arranged for, food is exactly at the right time, dresses are all made in the right time, the rooms are very well furnished, and everything is routinized, and everything goes clockwork, and there is no problem. There is good understanding among every people because everybody in the family shares the same comforts and everybody is happy. But evolution doesn't want merely stabilization of the physical. It wants stabilization of the physical, vital, mental, spiritual. So unless you have completed the whole cycle, this kind of collapse will always go on coming about. Now, this being the pattern of history, we have to judge whether we made a progress in one direction or not. If you only see from outside, we can say we build, it gets collapsed. We build, it gets collapsed. What is this return again and again to this regression? But if you try to understand what is the aim of history, what are the conditions of permanence, real permanence? Real permanence will not come to humanity. What is called the real Ramarajya, the real golden age, the real Suvarna Yoga, Satya Yoga, it will not come unless you establish physical, vital, mental, spiritual perfectly harmonized. The whole human history is moving in that direction. Now today we have reached a point where mental being, the intellectuality, is thriving and found that intellectual ideals cannot be sufficiently established unless you have peace. And now it is realized that you cannot have peace unless people develop spirituality. Because peace is not a concept merely of sitting down together on a dining table and have a peaceful meal. Peace means something in which the roots of quarrels are eliminated, in which the forces of domination are eliminated, in which the forces of lower pleasures are eliminated, then only peace will come. Otherwise, even if you take a good meal together, these forces will not be eliminated. So you will have always this problem. So, the essential problem is that today, all the great leaders realize that there is something deeper than the mind. There is something subtler than the mind. Take for example the idea of brotherhood. By some kind of law, you can spread the idea of liberty. If somebody suppresses you, you can go to the court of law and say, my freedom is suppressed. And court may give you judgment by which your freedom is restored. But real freedom cannot come to you unless the tendency which exists in human beings to bully you is eliminated. How much freedom the court can ensure you? If after going home, if there is some bully in your house, that freedom will be immediately thrown out. And for which you cannot go to the court of law again saying that, oh, he's scolding me all the time, he's all the time suppressing me, he's dominating over me. You can't do that all the time. So unless that bully himself is transformed into your real brother, a real friend, you cannot have liberty. Same thing about equality. You can go to the court of law to enforce that when my property and his property are to be equally divided, that court may do. But if after that there is encroachment constantly going on, even the small house, even if you divide equally, even for a small space, there are so many quarrels. Even you bring one new piece of furniture and the problem starts. How to arrange it, where to put it, where is the space for it. All kinds of problems arise and you cannot go to the court of law saying that now my equal rights have to be restored. It can come about only when there is an internal change in the consciousness of man. So the idea of brotherhood is very important. Without it, true equality and fraternity cannot be realized. True equality and liberty cannot be realized without this fraternity. It's a trinity. All the three have to be realized simultaneously. It's not that one or the other. Now today this realization has become very acute in mankind. And mankind is moving. That's why we say that mankind of today is in search of a real remedy. Why do we now read the Bhagavad Gita today? Because it is a spiritual message which is directly relevant to us today. That unless you live in the consciousness of immortality, which Sri Krishna gives in the second chapter, unless you know the idea as to how to do action and yet to be free from it, unless you attain to the real knowledge, jnana vijnana, that is in the seventh chapter, unless you know how to surrender to the divine, you cannot have equality, liberty and fraternity. So the ideas are today's. And we are going back to understand these ideas, how to implement them, because the real answer is given there, which was achieved in earlier times, which collapsed because it was not sufficiently widespread. Therefore, in today, we would like it to be widespread so that people share into this, then only this can be implemented. And in when you do this, you will find that even the original spiritual teaching will become modified, will become enriched. And that is the meaning of the development of spiritual consciousness. What was achieved in the Vedic times was, you might say, the pinnacles, loftiest. But thereafter, what has happened in the history of spirituality is that there has been subtlety of spirituality, complexity of spirituality, profundities of spirituality. Unless all these also are developed, even spiritual knowledge is not complete. The kind of devotion that we find in Sri Chaitanya is not in the Veda. The kind of love of Radha and Krishna that you find connected with Sri Krishna is not in the Veda. The heights and synthesis of knowledge that you find in the Upanishads is not in the Veda. That is why Upanishads are called Vedanta. The climax and the culmination of the Veda is in the Upanishads. So it is not, although the greatest heights are to be found in the Veda, all the subtleties are not in the Veda, all the complexities are not in the Veda, all the profundities are not in the Veda. You might say the seeds are there, but they have not sprouted, they have not developed, they have not given the benefit of them. That is why, even if you reach a great height, even in the field of spirituality, it is not enough. Even when dharma is established at one time, dharma established at one stage of human history is not enough. You have to develop the dharma and establish a further development of dharma in the next stage. Even that is not enough. A greater dharma has to come and that has to be developed. So when Sri Krishna says that I established dharma, we must understand the meaning of dharma. It is not as if by dharma is meant the same dharma which was proposed in Veda was established by Rama. And what was dharma in Rama's time was again established by Sri Krishna. That is not true. By word, very word, dharma means twofold. There is Sanatana dharma, the dharma which is eternal, which is still not on the earth. The eternal dharma is in the eternity. But here in temporal time, it is still not translated. So that Sanatana Dharma has to be understood in a sense as one that gradually gets developed in such a way that ultimately that image of Sanatana Dharma really gets fully manifested. Till that time, it is a developing Dharma. So the very word Dharma is a developing Dharma. So when Sri Krishna says, I come yuge yuge, I come from age to age and establish dharma, it is not as if he established the same dharma. The avatar comes one after the other, but each one does not give the same dharma. It is not Buddha does not give the same as Christ. Christ does not give the same thing as Krishna. In every age, the dharma that is needed at that time, the translation of Sanatana Dharma applicable to that time is fully revealed by the avatar. And he establishes that. It collapses. Why? Because it is still not the translation of the perfect Dharma. Because it is not there, there is a development and that Dharma begins to fall, to regress. Because new problems arise in the meantime, for which that dharma has no answer. The questions which were raised in the time of Rama were answered by Sri Rama through his own life, through his own example. And for his age, they were perfect answers. They could be sustained. But as the history developed further, newer questions came, for which the answer could not be found in the dharma established by Sri Rama. Now, India's greatness is to recognize it very clearly, and therefore to say the dharma established by Sri Rama had boundaries, had limitations, and Sri Rama himself was Maryada Purushottama. The other dharma had to be established when Sri Krishna came, He gave another dharma, which is in the Bhagavad Gita. And the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita and the teaching of Ramayana is not identical. There are wide differences. The kind of wideness that you find in Bhagavad Gita, the problems of how to reconcile knowledge with action and with bhakti, all that is not so amply given in Ramayana as in the Bhagavad Gita. So there is a new dharma which comes with Sri Krishna, and so on. So in every age, that is why he says, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati, he knows that dharma will go to gloom again. Why? Because the dharma that is given at this time is not that perfect dharma, not that ideal dharma. It is something which will answer the questions of the time. Then you have to develop it further. And so on. Therefore, until a time comes, therefore the India recognizes a time will come. And that is marked by Kalki. That concept is given in India. That is marked by Kalki. And that will be the beginning of Satya Yuga, where there is no possibility of collapse. So until we reach this point, we shall see in the history of mankind this kind of recurrence of rise and fall, rise and fall. But in every rise and fall, there is a design. The physical becomes vital, vital becomes mental. The physical becomes vitalized physical, and the vital ultimately becomes mentalized vital, and the mental begins to become spiritual. Then the spiritual will become vitalized, mentalized, the physicalized. In every way, the ultimate perfection will come when all the four principles, physical, vital, mental, spiritual, are so developed, so perfectly harmonized, that the whole edifice can stand without the necessity of a collapse. Now, if you examine from this point of view, we can now say that there has been a real progress in mankind. So to conclude, I'll give you again one passage from Srila Prabhupada. Yes.
And spoke about the Renaissance period. The Renaissance period was really a revival of the interest in classical literature, as well as pre-Christian. And that led to, this curiosity led to a certain amount of curiosity for art, literature, architecture, and everything, which is established. Today in India, are we at that threshold when we are actually going back to our roots, studying this literature, and perhaps it is more widespread now because there is greater education. And very slowly we are seeing amongst not just us, but a variety of people appealing to whatever kind of mind, depending on how simple they go. You don't see that happening in India. You see that we have reached that threshold when we are also, could perhaps be termed as a Renaissance, because we have that interest in our flat.
Well, you are quite right. In fact, since 19th century, we have entered into, in India, we have entered into that field, into the age of Renaissance. It is still not fructified because of various reasons.
Right.
But if you look into the developments of India between the 19th and early 20th century, we had already made big inroads into the Renaissance of India. In 1914 to 1921, Sri Aurobindo wrote a book called India's Renaissance, Indian Renaissance, Renaissance in India. So that is a book which I would like every Indian to read, because it shows the awakening of India and how India can become reborn. Unfortunately, there was a period when again we have lost the track. And after 50 years of independence, we again realize that we have lost something. And all over India, at least the thinking human beings of India are beginning to search as to where we got lost. That's why this revival at present, there is so much of appetite arising in India to understand, to go back. And Sri Aurobindo says that there are three tasks that modern India has to accomplish. First is to recover the ancient spiritual knowledge, particularly therefore of the Veda, Upanishads and the Gita. Why Gita is gripping us today? Because we find that there is something which answers our questions of today. Otherwise we won't read this book. These three great works of India, you might say, are immortal. Something that is supreme in spirituality and something that has a possibility of widening, of subtilizing, of deepening is all present in the Veda, Upanishads and the Gita. But even that is not enough, according to Sri Aurobindo. Even if you recover this, this is only the first step. The second step will be that you allow this knowledge to spread in all the modern subjects which are now coming upon us. It is not enough that now India will remain India as it is. The whole world is now at our gates and they are being poured upon us whether we like it or not. Therefore, with the strength of this knowledge, we should enter into the immense field of inquiry which is widespread all over the world. Assimilate the waters of this knowledge which are coming upon us. But these waters have to be purified, irrigated, refined, recovered, so that this knowledge irrigates this new knowledge which is coming from outside. It will be a real synthesis of the old and the new. And the new thing that will come about will be not merely Veda, Upanishad and the Gita. It will be even much greater knowledge. Such a great knowledge that the third task, Sri Aurobindo says, is that we have to change the whole society, social institutions, political institutions, economic institutions, in such a way that the dream of mankind in the field of equality, liberty, fraternity, which can be realized only on the spiritual foundation, which India possesses, and by development of the spirituality, with that new spirituality, you'll be able to realize those three ideals first in India. Because we have a ready possibility. And that is why Sri Aurobindo says the destiny of India is very great. Because we have all this possibility, we are ready to assimilate, we are assimilating today. Even the language that we are speaking is an assimilated language. And if you can recover this knowledge and develop fully, then those ideals which can't be realized there because they don't have this knowledge, although there also now there is an opening. The West is turning to the East. When Vivekananda went to Chicago and gave his powerful message, since that time, the West is awakened. And it is turning to the East. But our own response is much greater because even if they turn to India today, today's India is no example for the West. India will be an example if we can do all this work and show how truly liberty, equality and fraternity can be realized by the alchemy of spiritual knowledge, then we shall have fulfilled ourselves and we shall have served the world truly. Now this is the message of Sri Aurobindo, that these three tasks we have to do. Now we are in the process of that great task. To the extent to which we become aware of this task and fulfill it through ourselves and through our children and the next generation, if we can do this task, then we shall be able to go to that period where perhaps the collapse may not happen. So let us read this particular passage. It cannot truly be said that there has been no such thing as human progress since man's appearance or even in his recent ascertainable history. For however great the ancients, however supreme some of their achievements and creations, However impressive their powers of spirituality, of intellect, or of character, there has been in later developments an increasing subtlety, complexity, manifold development of knowledge and possibility in man's achievements, in his politics, society, life, science, metaphysics, knowledge of all kinds, art, literature. Even in his spiritual endeavor, less surprisingly lofty and less massive in power of spirituality than that of the ancients, there has been this increasing subtlety, plasticity, sounding of depths, extension of seeking. There have been faults from a high type of culture, a sharp temporary descent into a certain obscurantism, cessations of the spiritual urge, plunges into a barbaric natural materialism. But these are temporary phenomena. At worst, a downward curve of the spiral of progress. This progress has not indeed carried the race beyond itself into a self-exceeding, a transformation of the mental being. But that was not to be expected. For the action of evolutionary nature is a type of being, and consciousness is first to develop the type to its utmost capacity. By just such a subtilization and increasing complexity till it is ready for her bursting of the shell. The ripened decisive emergence, reversal, turning over of consciousness on itself that constitutes a new stage in the evolution. If it be supposed that her next step is a spiritual and supramental being, the stress of spirituality in the race may be taken as a sign that that is nature's intention. The sign, too, of the capacity of man to operate in himself or aid her to operate the transition. If the appearance in the animal being of a type similar in some respects to the ape kind, but already from the beginning endowed with the elements of humanity, was the method of the human evolution, then the appearance in the human being of a spiritual type resembling mental animal humanity, but already with the stamp of the spiritual aspiration on it, would be the obvious method of nature for the evolutionary production of the spiritual and supramental being. So considering from this point of view, if you judge it from this point of view, we must ask the question whether mankind today, on a large scale, has become capable of entering into the spiritual age. And if the answer is yes, then the answer is that mankind has made a progress. All right.